Welcome to Season 2 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 30, Summit the Board Game. Today, we are joined by Connor McGoey, the creator of Inside Up Games, the design and publishing company behind Summit, Vault Assault, Gorius Maximus, Sea Change, Seven Souls, The Quick and the Undead, City Builder, Ancient World, and Block and Key. Thanks, Connor, for joining me for the 30th episode.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Congratulations on 30 episodes.
Thanks. Yeah, it's going well. So for anyone who doesn't know you, would you mind just kind of explaining how you got into the game design community?
Sure. The fast version of the long story is that I grew up without a television because my mom hated TV. So we played a lot of board games as kids. I have three siblings. So we played a lot of cards and a lot of board games. And then as I grew up, I missed those board games. So I started playing them with my now wife. And I ran a construction company and I couldn't turn my brain off at night. So I would basically just come up with random board game ideas that I thought were fun. And for years, friends told me I should design something. So I designed Summit. That's the fast version.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, you know, it's weird because my dad used to put a cap on our television watching. We only got an hour a day. And then I eventually was like, well, Dad, movies are longer than an hour. Are you telling me I should like watch part of it today and part of it tomorrow? I used to get around it. But that's so funny.
We do the same thing with our kids. And one of the things that we try is we do like a minute for minute. So for every minute of music lessons that they practice, they get a minute of screen time. Oh. So if they want to sit down and hammer out tunes for an hour, they can get an hour of time. And unfortunately, that's fallen a little bit lax over the current pandemic as we're all trapped in the same house together. But yeah, it worked pretty well.
You're going to just have a bunch of music prodigies or a rock band. That's awesome.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, maybe if they get their musical ability from me, it might not go so well.
Oh, geez. Well, hopefully it's not from you. All right. So then Summit, that's what you're here for. And that is your first game. For anyone who doesn't know about it, would you mind explaining how to play?
Yeah, for sure. So it's a game that can be played competitively, cooperatively, or solo. So when I came up with the design ideas for it, I was actually just basically laying awake in bed at night on December 24th, waiting for the previously mentioned munchkins to fall asleep. And I was actually out of town at my wife's place in Manitoba. My wife's parents' place. And I just wanted to come up with some ideas, some mechanics, and some themes that could work. Because in my group of board gamers here in town, I'm usually the guy who has the games, learns the rules, teaches everybody, picks the games, all that sort of stuff. And one of the things that people who have that role struggle with is, you know, picking the right games for the right people that are coming over the right times and all that. So I really wanted to create a game that could do kind of anything. So if you had people that want to play competitive, you can play competitive. If they want to play cooperative, you can play cooperative. And if nobody showed up, you could play it by yourself. So I wanted to come up with a theme that kind of worked. I love theme in my board games. For the right games. I also love abstract games. But for me, I wanted, you know, a theme that kind of carried those mechanics hand in hand. So I thought of some, the obvious options are survival, because as humans, we can, you know, survive alone. We can survive, you know, working together with others. And we can survive while trying to, you know, compete with others, or, you know, survive better than the others, or however you want to put it. So survival was kind of the obvious choice for me. But then it came down to like what kind of survival, because there are a billion post-apocalyptic games and zombie games and end of the world games, and they're done really, really well by companies, you know, with established backgrounds and budgets, and I obviously had none of that. So I started thinking about kind of what I knew, and it isn't until looking back on it since then that I realized at the time when I was still working construction, and one of my clients at that time is a mountaineer, and he had just finished summiting Everest. And so him and I would chat quite often about some of his different climbing experiences. So that was clearly in the back of my mind at the time. And it popped in, you know, a mountain climbing game. I hadn't seen a lot of them. I hadn't played many of them. And I thought that could work because there's a bunch of interesting mechanics that could be worked into a game built around that. So I just took my iPhone out, jotted down some ideas I had of different mechanics and themes and things that I would want in a game if I was to purchase a mountain climbing survival game. And I wrote them all down to my phone and then kind of left it for the rest of that holiday season. And then getting back to town, I took out, you know, a pizza box out of the recycling bin and some Sharpie out and, you know, started creating these original ideas. And what I ended up creating was basically a two-sided playing board that uses triangular shaped tiles. Because again, I wanted to do something a little bit different. And, you know, hexagons, octagons, squares, all these other tile shapes have been done quite often. So I wanted something a little bit different. So but I also didn't know if it would work. So I, you know, did some very basic testing on if the idea worked, if it was interesting, and then what I could work into it. So then fast forward a little bit of time, and I basically created a game where you can, yeah, choose which side of the board you want to play, depending if you want to play competitively or cooperatively. And if you're playing competitively, it's a race up and down the mountain while making points for pole position as you arrive at different waypoints. So you start at the base camp and you make your way up through the halfway camp to the summit and then back down through the halfway camp to base camp if you can survive. You'll make points for that. The game is made a lot more interesting because I added something that I thought would be more interesting, which was a karma track. So during the race, you are actually able to play cards to actively help or hurt your friends as you're playing the game. So if I want to be helpful to you and play a card that's going to, you know, speed you up or give you more food or oxygen or supplies, then I'm going to gain karma for being a nice guy. But I also might help you too much so that you beat me in the race. So you need to be careful. At the same time, maybe someone's doing really, really well in front of you and you need to slow them down so you can play karma cards to hurt them, to, you know, to give them some sort of bad thing. Maybe they lose oxygen or their food goes bad or, you know, they roll their ankle while climbing or something like that. But then you're going to lose karma for being mean. So it's a balance of, you know, when to be nice, when to be mean. And it creates this rubber band effect where players are actively, you know, targeting those players in the lead, but then helping those players, you know, who are falling behind. So it's always a very tight racing group. And then as people are coming back down the mountain, they have to run across the same people who they've, you know, picked on or helped going back up the mountain. If you're playing the cooperative or the solo mode of the game, the board's flipped over. And instead of the karma track, there is a Sherpa track. And then instead of the pole position, there is a time of day. And then this version's built a little bit more around reality, where you probably wouldn't be trying to kill the people on the mountain with you. And in this one, there is no halfway camp. So the players have to either as a solo or work together to get from the base camp to the summit and back. And I created a whole nother deck of event cards that get shuffled into the events. And those will now target you and the Sherpas you have who carry your extra supplies on the mountain. So there is a little bit of everything. There is tile laying to build a new mountain every time you play with different types of tile that are, you know, harder to traverse or require oxygen. There is some dice rolling for a little bit of luck to see what the mountain, what kind of, you know, environment and weather hazards you might run into. And then there's resource management to impress your luck in that every player has their own dual-layered asymmetrical player board where everybody has their own character with their own stats and abilities. And each of those characters and players is responsible for carrying their own food and oxygen. But as those food and oxygen markers move up the board, there are little icons that help teach you. And you will obviously get heavier as you carry more supplies. And the heavier you get, the slower you move. The good news being that as you use those supplies and you get lighter, you actually move faster. So there's this, you know, self-regulating mechanic visible to all players, but it's something that you need to keep in mind as you're either working competitively or cooperatively.
And how did you decide to make like food, oxygen, weight, health, and speed the main components on the player board that you're trying to balance? And
well, again, it's just I come from a very logic based background of, you know, whether it's problem solving or anything I'm kind of applying in my life, my child raising. It's kind of a more of a fact based, logic based learning where it just makes sense to me. I mean, if I'm climbing a mountain, what do I need? I need equipment. I need food, I need oxygen. And what happens when I have that? Well, I need to put it somewhere. I need to carry it somewhere. Well, once I carry it, I can't just carry it. I don't have unlimited bag of holding here. I can't put 47, you know, broadswords in a bag and carry it for 7 hours. I actually need to have some sort of reason for why I'm being affected by things. And as you know, as you get heavier, you're going to be moving slower. And because it's a race, that speed is an important thing. But then again, if you don't bring enough food, you don't bring enough oxygen containers, well, then now all of a sudden, you're going to have to be worrying about your actual health of your player. And as you get as you lose health, I should say, you're going to slow down. That's just how life is, right? As you kind of get burnt out. The good news being that as you get healthier, you will move faster again. So again, it came from a logical point of it just makes sense to me that these things should affect it. Because for me personally, as a player, the more logical a mechanic is and the better interweaved it is into the theme of a game, the easier it is for players to learn, because it just makes sense to them. You go, I need to eat food. Oh, I don't have food to eat. I guess that's going to, you know, cost me health. So just all these little steps should help players kind of remind them as they're playing, but also make that learning process a little easier.
Oh, that definitely makes sense. And I know you said you did the like triangle tiles, which I thought was really cool. But what was your thought process between the three different types of rope? I think it was like you had yellow, blue, and white, maybe?
Brown, yeah. So brown. Well done. Brown ropes are neutral. So they have little green trees. It's kind of a visual reminder of green means go. So those are neutral in the game means nothing happens. And the joke I like to make with new players is that if nothing's happening, that's good, because more bad things happen than good things on the mountain. So brown, the ropes are basically, it's an audio show. So basically, if you can imagine a triangle, there are three possible center knot points. So if you imagine each side of a triangle and there's a knot in the center of each of those sides, so there's two short sides and one long side, and those knots can be connected in seven different possible rope layouts. So those rope layouts are repeated through the three different types of rope. The neutral rope means nothing's happening. The yellow rope means that you need to use oxygen. There's little dead trees on there, so you need to use oxygen as you enter those tiles. And then lastly are the blue, and there are just more knots on the blue tiles, which effectively is slowing your player down, and we're calling those the icy tiles. So it just makes you move a little bit slower as there are more knots to traverse them. Again, that was just something I thought could be more interesting, more thematic, and to create that new mountain every time you're playing. So if every single, you know, triangle had the same rope pattern, then there's no point. You don't care about drawing tiles. If every tile was the same, again, you wouldn't care about what you had, when you had it, or how you used it. But in this case, it really matters about your planning and your strategy of which tile do I use when. Some tiles, you know, have a nice straight line on them. It's easy to move the long length of the tile fastest. Seems great, except for the fact that if you only have one line going up a mountain, if anything happens to that one line, you're all in big trouble. So, you know, creating these Y lines are more important, backup lines, alternate routes for, you know, if something happens on the mountain. So luckily, all these stories that I, you know, I've grown up, either we've watched movies, read books, or talked to friends about, all these horrible things that can happen on mountain, I've basically worked them into the game, either mechanically, thematically, or through event cards.
From what you're saying, like, did that make you want to climb mountains more or less when you're making this game?
Well, I'm an outdoors person by nature. I live in a small town in northern Ontario that gets quite cold in the winter, but it's quite beautiful year round. And I wouldn't be here if I wasn't a nature person. So the cold doesn't bother me as much. And the dangerous life choices didn't bother me as much until I had kids. And now I have some other people to think about instead of just myself. So it's unlikely that I would do an Everest or something like that. I mean, there's other environmental and social economical issues with that as well that I won't get into right now. But those sort of dangerous, unnecessary dangerous days are kind of past me at this point in my life. But I've done like warm weather climbing and rope climbing and stuff like that, but always with someone much more experienced in a much safer environment.
I definitely get that. I rock climb and I would not go outside unless I was with someone who knows a lot more than me.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, geez. And so since this is your first game, like, what made you decide to make a game that has a solo mode, a co-op, and just a competitive? Like, how did you start to develop and play test? Did you just choose one of those and then develop the next part? Like, what was the process?
Well, originally I really wanted to create it all in one game. So originally I was hoping to do it on one side of the board. And as I designed it, it worked on one side of the board, and that was fine. And basically the tracks were just replaceable. So depending on what game you had, these tracks would change, which side, and you just lay them over top of the board. But it was really kind of about that I needed a game that was different, and I can make a little bit of a splash. The board game world is a very busy place with a lot of publishers putting out a lot of content yearly. And I just needed something to kind of, you know, get attention. So if I could kind of make that claim and prove that it was doable to kind of have this all-in-one package in a board game, that was kind of my goal. Because if I was just going to make another game that was similar to everybody else's games, then why would anybody care to try mine? So that was kind of the starting point. And then it developed very kind of naturally. I did take time. I probably spent about a year, just over a year, maybe developing and refining the game. But most of it kind of developed very, very naturally. And just like, again, that boring answer of a logical basis of, okay, like, this just makes sense. This just makes sense. And very much from the point of, you know, if we were competing, what would be important? If we were cooperating, what would be important? And kind of what those different venues for options are. And then working into the game. So creating that really solid structure of like, what are the main things? So mountain climbing game, and I mean, obviously that works with both characters and the stats that we've already gone over, that very easily works in both. The tile placement works in both. So all you really needed to rework at that point was kind of the goal of the game. And then once I had those hammered out, you know, the race versus the strict survival, and then what works within those two things. So how do you make that race more interesting? How do you make that survival mode more interesting? Like, and how do you really differentiate them so that different people can enjoy the game in different ways? And one of the things that I like to say is during the promotion of the game, when we were getting attention for it, which was very nice, when it came out, Man versus Meeple loved the game because they said it was one of the meanest games you could play. The competitive game was just so cutthroat, and you could just be so, you know, actively competitive against each other that they loved it, and they gave it their seal of approval. And then when it came time to the Dice Tower, they're not a big fan of Take That Games, or they weren't at the time anyways. And so they weren't as much a fan of the competitive side, but they loved the cooperative side, and they gave it their seal. So the fact that I got two seals from two, you know, well-recognized companies on two different modes of the game really made me kind of feel like I was able to get these two spaces to areas, you know, they needed to be. And one of the funny things I hear often is I'll have fans and players who will, for example, have only ever played one type of the game because they just love it so much. So one of the guys I love to tease often is Jamie Stegmeier, who was very kind. I thanked him hopefully very publicly. A lot of his lessons and stuff is kind of what helped me understand Kickstarter and board game. And I studied a lot of his writing and his projects when preparing to launch Summit on Kickstarter. So I ended up sending him a copy of the game as a thank you for his work, because he puts all of his stuff online and he's very open and transparent and very generous with his time and his knowledge. So I sent him a copy of the game. And he ended up playing it, and in his copy of the game, and he's recounted this story numerous times. He was one step out of base camp at the very start of the game, cooperative with his friends. And right after leaving camp, he decided that he needed to eat his Sherpa. So due to the event card, his Sherpa immediately disappeared, and he got a bunch of extra food supplies that came from a questionable source. So he's loved it. He's been very supportive. But because of that, he routinely lists Summit as one of his top cooperative games of all time, but he still has never played the competitive side just because he enjoys the cooperative so much. And I keep teasing him, telling him he has to try it, but he teases me back and says he loves the co-op side too much.
That's so funny. I've only played the competitive side because I played it at Gen Con, I think, in like 2019.
Okay.
Yeah, I did win, but Jesus Christ, was it rough. Like, every time I rolled those dice for the weather and the events, I was like, are you kidding me? Like you said, like, more bad things happen on the mountain than good. And I was just like, this is ridiculous.
There's a couple things that I love when demoing the game for people at conventions. And one is when people get to the top and they say, well, I got to the top, that wasn't so bad. And I'm like, yeah, you need to get back down. Getting up the mountain is only half the battle. Yeah. Or when someone makes a mistake early on in the game of saying, well, this isn't so bad, it seems pretty easy. You're like, yeah, just wait. Although one of the issues that I've had with the game is when I designed it, I also, again, because I wanted to create this, you know, a game that could do almost anything within the confines of the mechanic and the theme, I created difficulty settings where you can basically choose if you want an easy game or a harder game. All the way from very easy to very hard. And that depends where you'd start that halfway camp, but it would also mean that your starting weather would be more severe as your difficulty went up. So when you're playing on a very easy setting, the weather starts off much calmer and builds much slower. And the mountain is much shorter as the base camp is moved higher up the hill. But one of the issues I would have would be first time players who would, either email me or, reach out through BGG and just say, I had a problem with the game. It was too easy. And I'll say, okay, well, what difficulty setting did you play it on? And they'll say, well, on very easy. And I'm like, oh, okay, so may I suggest you play it on medium or perhaps hard and to have a medium or a hard experience. But it was just funny to me that I did get a fair number of emails of people saying that they played the game on easy and it was too easy. And I'd have to write back and be, okay, well, you could change the difficulty setting if you'd like a harder game.
Yeah, that is an interesting comment. They clearly didn't read the rules, but you know what? Teach their own.
But it's funny. You get comments like that or questions like that all the time that just make you like hesitate, or someone will ask a question about like, how does this work? And all of a sudden you'll panic and go like, oh my, did I not cover that in the rule? Like, is that not? And you like panically go through the rules. You're like, oh no, it's a big section right here, clearly labeled. It just, but you get asked the strangest questions. It's very odd.
And how did you go about playtesting this game?
So I started, luckily I had friends that I've been playing board games with for years here locally in town. So I basically just started with them, just seeing if the game actually made sense, if the base mechanics, if the bones of the game were good, if the interest was there. And I basically started very slowly kind of doing that, and it worked. And then it got to a point where it was my Sharpie on cutout cardboard. And it was just, it really didn't help with the theme. It just, as players were playing it was much harder to kind of like imagine yourself there when you're moving with this, this fiddly, crappy components. So I reached out to a friend and a very smart businessman who's an artist and a graphic designer who I'd luckily worked with through my construction career. And he had, designed my website. He had designed the decals on my truck. He had painted my goalie mask for hockey. He had designed a tattoo for my wife. He's just one of these guys who's just unbelievably creative and talented. His name's Jordan Danielson, and he runs Lost Art up here in Thunder Bay as well and does a lot of stuff online. And he's not only a nice guy, but just like, as I say, he's a creative force. And at the time, again, I didn't realize how lucky I was to have met and worked with an illustrator and graphic designer, kind of that complete package. So I basically roped him in and I said, explained to him what I was doing and, asked if he wanted to kind of join me on this journey. And we worked together, and it was a long and slow and painful process. But the reason for that was that he was meticulous in creating the assets needed for the game. So he created every single thing you could think of for the game. So when it came time to build the actual rule book, the assets, the ads, the marketing, everything, there was this massive, chest of content to pick from. So anything you can imagine was there. And he would design with the illustrations in mind, and he would draw with the graphic design in mind. So it was really, really nice. So he basically came onto the project and then made it attractive and interesting to play. So that meant that all the testing and the prototypes just looked better and had more engagement and more interesting for the players. The one downside to that is I spend way more time than I care to admit on creating new prototypes. Anytime some of the art was updated, I would always create a new one and create a new one and create a new one. And it wasn't until years later where I found literally these, storage containers, like these rubber bins full of Summit prototypes that I'd gone through. And I was like, oh my goodness, did I actually make that many different versions of the tile? Like, how impatient was I? Why didn't I just, wait for this one or wait for that one? So I would just, have these things and then test them over and over, and people really enjoyed it. And then one of the interesting experiences I had was that, again, as mentioned, I'm from a small town. So I kind of have that feeling of, am I just, small town? Is this going to last anywhere else? So I flew down to Toronto I brought Jordan with me and the game to kind of do some play testing at one of the designer nights at Snakes and Lattes in Toronto. So I went to the event and I was just you know, stressed out about, you know, being the small fish in a big pond now. But one of the interesting things I encountered there was that I had put a lot more work into the prototype design, so that when I was actually at this design night, most people were at that stage of just, you know, the cardboard and the Sharpies. So my design would have been fine to bring as it was, but I was just so worried about, you know, how it would look in the big city. When, you know, is everyone going to laugh me out of the building if I have this, you know, this crappy looking thing. But the nice thing was, is it impressed all of them. So I got a lot of interest from, and a lot of support from the design community in and around the Toronto area, who came in and saw the game and played the game. And that actually led to one of the important realizations that I think all designers should go through, and that is just taking feedback with a grain of salt. And what happened to me was I had spent a lot of time designing, building, playtesting, checking, refining, and tweaking with our playtesters. But then I went with this opinion that, you know, I'm just a small guy from a small town. And so I got some feedback from players who had played the game for the first time. And I gave, you know, it too much credit. Where I'm like, oh, you know, I should do that. So I made these changes to the, or I tried to make these changes to the game based on that, on one person's feedback or two people's feedback after one play. And I just realized that it was a cascading effect of not working. So it seemed like it was an interesting idea to make this thing work, but it actually, it would break this mechanic, would make this mechanic less useful, make this one not make sense anymore. And it just created this issue. So, one of the things that's just oh so important is to create, you know, the playtesting sheets, which I had to, you know, to gather feedback from, but to also make sure that you have reoccurring feedback of issues, that you're not putting too much weight into one person's opinion. And I'll say that to anyone who, you know, who submits designs to us now, because I've published three other designs by outside designers now for InSetup Games, and I'll do three more this year. But one of the things I tell them is, when I'm being pitched these games or when I'm playtesting a game with them, after the fact, when it's done, is I'll give them some of my feedback. And what I'll say to them is, like, look, this is my opinion. I'm one person. I've played the game one time. So make sure you do what's best for you and what's best for your game, because someone else might love the stuff I hated and hate the stuff I love. So just make sure that, you know, you're always true to you and your design.
No, I think that's really important, especially when you haven't done a lot of playtesting with other designers too, in general. Mm-hmm. I'm honestly super jealous, because I have always wanted to go to Snakes and Lattes in Toronto, because you, like, out there, they have just such a great design community. And it's so weird to think that just, like, this perfect little group just randomly appeared in Canada and they all just, like, bonded. And I've had a few of them on the show, and I get very jealous. I want to check it out someday.
Yeah, they've done a really good job, and the stores, the way they've done their, you know, their board game cafes is impressive. It's done really well.
It is. And when did you decide to start InSetup Games and go the self-publishing route?
So that was interesting. So that would have been probably just under a year into the design and development of Summit. I had created it, and for a little bit more backstory, I had, unfortunately, I got sick. So I ran a construction company for about 10 years, but I got sick, and that landed me in the hospital for a while. And it was during that time where I was able to really kind of focus on the, you know, on Summit's development, just because I couldn't do my construction work. So it was really nice that I kind of had this little pause where I was able to do this. But the good and the bad side was, I eventually was getting better and I was going back to work. But now I had a construction company I was running, a board game I was designing, and three very small children at that point. And my poor wife said, look, you need to make up your mind, like, what we're doing here, because you can't spend, you know, 10 hours a day running a construction company and then 4 hours every night doing board game stuff. There's just no time left for you to kind of be around for the kids and, you know, help me out, which is very fair. So, I kind of said, okay, well, I need to do something with design, and I didn't know what to do. And my brother-in-law was actually the one who asked me if I was going to kickstart it. And at that point, I had heard of Kickstarter maybe once or twice, never used it, never backed anything, never had any experience with it. So him and I looked into it, and the project he showed me was Jamie Stegmeier's Scythe. So I looked into that and I was like, oh my God, I'm not, no, I can't compete with these guys. This is insane. Look at what he does, and look at the production quality and the art and the graphic design and, you know, the minis and all this sort of stuff. And Neil, my brother-in-law, laughed. So he showed me some other stuff. He's like, yeah, this guy just, he knows what he's doing. But, you know, here are some other people who are, you know, kind of in your same boat, in your same, you know, startup stage. So I looked around to that, and that's where I really jumped into that information. So I backed Scythe. I kind of followed along. I learned a lot by just that campaign, but it also led me down the rabbit hole of kind of Jamie's online teachings, as strange as that sounds. Basically his vault of information that he shares completely for free. And then his crowdfunding book, which I bought as well. And I just kind of delved into all this stuff because it was an area I knew nothing about. And coming from that logical background, I just wanted to get as much information as I could about something I wanted to try to do. So I figured that was probably a better bet for me than it would be to try to pitch my game to a company. So I just basically jumped into the Kickstarter realm, backed tons of projects to follow along, see how they did it, see, you know, what I thought worked, what I thought didn't work, everything from board games to every type of project that Kickstarter offers, you know, the music, arts, design, products. I basically backed everything I could just to kind of see what the different things were that were happening and how Kickstarter worked. And then, I guess it would have probably been early in 2016. I guess is when I launched on Summit on Kickstarter, and it was one of the most stressful times I've had of just like kind of putting yourself out there, just being really kind of vulnerable of saying like, hey, this is something I have created of my own that I know I've come up with and I've worked so hard on it. What do you think of it? And it was a really rewarding, sometimes humbling experience. But it was great. And that was, like I say, 6 years ago now, I guess. And I've done 8 Kickstarters since then. And our ninth, I think, will be launching next month.
That's so impressive. And what made you decide on the name?
Of Summit?
No, of Inside Up Games.
Oh, so Inside Up Games. So my wife is a French-Canadian from Manitoba. And one of the things that I like to tease her about is she'll mix up her inside out, upside down, and backwards when she's talking in English. So she flips all of them around. It's one of the few things. You wouldn't know that she was first language French because her English sounds just like mine. But every once in a while, a word will come out and you're like, wait a second. So that's one of the things she would mix up. So for me, I thought it was fun because inside up isn't something that's normally said, but it's also kind of how board games work, and that it's the inside the box that you're taking out. It's inside up. You're taking it out of the box. You're setting it up on the table. So just kind of combine all these little things. And it seemed unique enough at the time.
That's a super cute way to name a publishing company. That's adorable. And then when did you start creating the expansions for the game? Was that something like as you were developing, you kind of cut some stuff out and then you're like, actually let's add it?
So the first one was actually funny. So the first expansion was Yeti, and that is completely thanks to my friendly local game store owner, Jackie. So her and Dave have been very, very supportive. They run the game shelf here in Thunder Bay, and they're absolute sweethearts. So during the time of setup, I had been buying board games from Jackie and from them for years. And she was kind of my drug dealer of choice, in that I would go in there and she would know what games I kind of liked. And she's probably, you know, sold me hundreds of games over the years. And I can think of one that was like less than awesome, but the rest of them were like bang on the mark for like what I would like and how I like to play and all this sort of stuff. So she was great. They continue to be amazing. And so when I was going through the design process, she was very interested in kind of helping out in any way she could. And she would offer to have, you know, playtest sessions at the store and set things up and release, you know, the Kickstarter release was there, a whole bunch of things. And during the playtesting of the game, we were playing and everything was going wrong for her. I think we were playing cooperatively, and everything was like, every roll of hers was bad. Every event card she drew was bad. Anything that could happen on the mountain, it always happened to her. And she was just laughing and she's like, it can't get any worse. And she picked up one of the event cards and she said, what's next? Is a Yeti going to attack me? And I was like, Not yet. So then I created the Yeti expansion, where there's an actual another meeple, a Yeti, that will hunt you on the mountain. So in the cooperative mode, he hunts you and your friends, going after the healthiest player until they're weakened, and then he goes after the next healthiest player. And in the competitive version, you can actually use the karma cards to and the weather dice to actually, you know, move him around the board against your competitors. And then because I created that, I'm like, well, at the same time, I may as well create more event cards, karma cards, and item cards that kind of go along with that, the Yeti theme, the Yeti mechanics, and then some new player boards as well. So that's how the first one came along. And then the second one, I'm trying to think how I had the idea for the second one. I don't really remember. But one of the things that happens in Summit, as experienced players will tell you, is that the mountain is usually trying to kill you. And often your plans can go amiss. And, you know, whether your route is blocked, whether there's a collapse, a crevice, an avalanche, whatever it is, you know, you can just get stuck in bad places and your character could die on the mountain. So the game is harder, has more bad things than good things. So one of the things I wanted to do was to create something to make it a little bit easier for players sometimes to kind of get out of these I have no way out situations. So I created climbing ladders, which are actually square tiles, which get placed over top of the triangular tiles. So you can actually create new routes over top of old routes or over top of blocked areas. But then these climbing ladders also have weight to them as well, just like other items do. So it means you kind of got to worry about how much stuff you're carrying. And the reason I wanted to make it a little bit easier was that I created the team variant, where you could basically work in teams and then still play the game competitively or cooperatively. So if it's a team competitive game, it's, you know, team A and B or team A, B and C, you know, racing for these things where you're going to combine the values, but you're actually, you know, helping each other. So you're clearly going to be using those good karma cards on your teammates and those bad karma cards on your opponents. And if it's cooperative game, then you're, you know, it's a cooperative survival game of, you know, getting up and down the mountain. And the team game ended up, just by the nature of helping your teammate and hurting someone else, it actually got to be, it could be pretty mean against each other. So I had to create a whole bunch of karma cards and event cards that were nice to offset the natural competitiveness that players had, because there was just so much more, strategizing, but more like evil
planning
of whispers. Yeah, just like, okay, make sure you give them food, and when they accept it, I'm gonna poison it, and like all this kind of like evil, jeez, like giggling around the table of people playing. And one of the stories I can tell is I have a buddy who actually I met through Summit. His name's Greg Sochin. He's in Winnipeg, and he's my booth babe at pretty much every convention we go to, and he's been an amazing friend and supporter for years. But I was really nervous about showing him teams, because he doesn't sugarcoat things. He tells me what he thinks all the time, and whether I want to hear it or not most of the time, but which is very good for a small business. You need someone like that. And so when I taught him the teams game, we were playing, and I had one of my children on my team and one of my children was on Greg's team, and we were playing together, and you know, me and my one, my eldest daughter were whispering back and forth to each other, and he was whispering with my son and going back and forth as we're plotting our way up this mountain. And I looked over at him, and he actually, his eyes had teared up, and I was like, Greg, what's going on? And he just looked at me and said, I love it. I was like, oh, good. Ooh, I was worried. But yeah, so that was basically, that was a high point for the team's design.
And then how long in total do you think it took to go from inspiration to publication of the initial game? Like, it's officially in the hands of backers. They're playing it and they're telling you how they like the game.
Well, so we'll see if my old memory is any good. So if memory serves, it would have been Christmas Eve 2014. That I had the original idea. I would have spent 2015 designing it, developing it and tweaking it. Early 2016 is when the Kickstarter was. And then if I remember right, it was early 2017 when it hit backers' hands. So it would have been like 2.5 years from idea to release. Yeah, probably about 2.5 years. But again, that's because it was my first game and because I was running another company full time and I had 3 small kids. I can do it a lot faster now.
I mean, that's still a pretty decent timeline. as far as like anyone who maybe pitched a game to some publisher. It's true. It's still in the realm of good time.
Yeah, I've talked to some people who have, you know, been designing and developing a certain game and they've been doing it for, you know, 5+ years for a single game and it's still in the pitch phase. And I'm like, oh, wow, like good for you.
Yep, very true. And then now that it's published, how do you think the game's doing? I know I've still seen it at conventions.
Yeah, it's still one of our best sellers, if not our best seller. It's constantly moving. It moves in the hobby world and, you know, friendly local game stores. It moves online and it sells really well for us at conventions just because I guess it was our flagship for so long. And so people have heard of it. We're not one of these massive companies that everybody knows, but they've heard of some of our titles, which helps us. So maybe, you know, Goris Maximus, they had heard of at a convention they had played or whatever it would have been. So they kind of recognize it and I'll bring them over and then they'll see, oh, Summit, I've heard of that game. So they'll sit down and play it. And that's one of the struggling points that Inside Up Games have is we're kind of in that small to medium size where it's such a busy business that, you know, getting that market share of people's interest has always been tricky. But once we can get them to, you know, sit down and play a game, any one of our games, then they usually become fans and followers and supporters, which is great. Luckily that knowledge of, oh, I've heard of that game. I know someone who has that game. I've seen that game. That kind of really helps us. And it actually, I was surprised by it when I did the team's Kickstarter, because that would have been maybe 2019, possibly 2018 or 2019. So it was a couple of years after Summit came out. So I was just expecting, you know, to sell, you know, copies to people who had backed the original Kickstarter and hopefully a couple of people who would have picked it up in retail since then. But what I wasn't expecting at that time was a massive surge of people who had seen it originally on Kickstarter years ago and not backed it and missed it. So they came in at that point and backed it, bought Summit, bought Yeti, and bought Teams all at the same time through the Teams Kickstarter. So we actually had more new to our company game than we had people coming from back. It was just a massive flood of people who had heard of the game and wanted to get it.
That's so cool. I know I didn't get a chance to play either expansion, but the Yeti one sounds both terrifying and fun.
Yeah, the Yeti one's great. It 100% makes the game harder, and it's already a hard game. So I tell people, like, this is really, like, this doesn't make anything easier. It just makes everything about the game more difficult. But if you like that, and if you like variability in the game, it does add, as I say, more of every type of card. More karma cards, more item cards, more event cards, and more player boards. and then the Teams one is fun, especially for either new players where you can kind of take, you know, one experienced player takes a new player under their wing and they play together, or for those experienced players who kind of know the ins and outs of the game to really kind of maximize those strategic points.
That's so fun. And then as far as the whole design journey, do you have like a favorite and least favorite experience?
Oh, good question. It was, I mean, going through that first Kickstarter experience of you kind of expect, and it could be a bad idea sometimes, but you kind of expect, you know, that family and friends support. But the board gamer support was kind of a nice thing for me, because family and friends would support you usually no matter what, at least that for that first Kickstarter. But to have people you don't know come out and support you, people who just like see the video or read the rule book and be like, yeah, this game, like, cool, this game interests me. I want to help you out. And then every time since then where I've either demoed the game or taught the game or had people from past conventions come up and just tell me their stories. Because one of the things that happens with Summit is a story is created every time you play because of what happens, the choices you make, and these event cards and karma cards that get played, is that I get told these amazing stories of people who like are laughing about it or just like, it was, you know, it was so infuriating. I couldn't do this properly and blah, blah, blah. So we played it again right away. And like all these, just these amazing stories that people come at is probably my high point. And it's been, yeah, over 5 years now of people telling me, you know, the stories of what's happened to them in their game. And it's just so neat that to think about people having these like shared experiences all around the world with something, you know, that created, you know, in my brain originally. For a negative during the design process, there hasn't been a ton of negatives to my experience. I have some weird ability that my wife likes to tease me about where I can remember good things and I forget the bad things. I don't let them stick with me.
I mean, that's fine. Hey, if you don't remember anything negative, that's something that I wish everybody could put away into the closet and only remember the positive.
So I got one. So I guess one of the negative things that happened to me was, again, that feeling of I'm new, I'm not good enough, I don't know what I'm doing. So when I worked with the manufacturer for the first version of the game, I was probably much more timid than I should have been. And for anyone who knows me, they would not believe that I could ever be timid. But I didn't know enough about that side of the publishing business. I didn't kind of know what I think needed to be done. Sorry, I know what I think needed to be done, but I didn't know how to express it and how to kind of demand that from a manufacturing partner. So there were a lot of issues with timelines, with communication, with the actual manufacturing of the game, where in my head, for example, I imagine that if I submitted something, the company would say, you know, oh, cool, but if you did this to it, that would be better for this reason. For example, if you can see in Summit, and it's true to this day, the punch board sheet is slightly smaller than the box height. Now, that seems super minor and doesn't really matter, but the cost difference to make it the full size would be minor at the end of the day. And because I use it to raise the insert slightly so that everything is held perfectly closed in when the box stored vertically, it's really important to me that everything about the game is for gamers, is that the design, the inserts, the storage solution, everything is done really, really well. But it was all done purely from my experience as a board gamer, not from manufacturing. So there are things that I did that definitely were not cost effective. There were things that I did that, you know, slowed the production down for reasons that were not needed. And there was just, you know, me being either too polite or too patient, and, you know, not being pushy enough, not being that squeaky wheel to get the grease, where there was, you know, a number of issues that came up with the manufacturer, where it was, you know, very poor communications and big issues, and, you know, resulted in a couple, emails of like, we need to have a discussion immediately because this is not working. So I would say that was definitely the low point. But again, the reason why I didn't think of it immediately as a low point is that I learned a lot from it. You know, that people say you learn so much from your failures, and it really helped me to understand, you know, what I needed to do as a publishing company, what I needed to, you know, expect and ask for and push on to kind of make sure that I'm getting the best product for my customers.
That definitely makes sense. Manufacturing is confusing. It's hard to know what to ask if you don't know the right words, but I'm glad that it worked out.
Yeah, is that realistically, like, they don't need to care about your game. They're just making it. So if you tell them you want a six-sided die with the number one on six sides of that die, that's what they will make you, right? They don't need to say, well, why do you need a six-sided die if it's all the same number? Nothing's changing. Like, they don't need to ask you questions about stuff. There are some manufacturers that are quite good. There are some, you know, people you work with that will ask you and kind of help you and stuff like that, but not all of them. They're just there to make what you ask them to make. So I get that, but it was not obvious to me when as a first-time publisher.
Hey, but I mean, everyone learns, so exactly. That's good. And then if you were to teach or like give one piece of advice to a designer, what would it be then?
So as a designer, not as a publisher, the advice I usually give designers is make it. It's just make the darn prototype as simply as you can. Stop. Don't spend a year writing a rule book for a game you haven't tested. Don't spend a year on artwork and graphic design. Like, get the bare bones skeleton of your game on the table and see if it works and see if it's fun. Because all that other time you spent writing that rule book before the game actually works, or all that time you've and money you've spent on art or graphic design could be wasted. Just get it out, see if the game works. That's when you're going to find your biggest flaws.
So true. I know I used to make really beautiful looking prototypes, which, yes, brings playtesters over, but it's such a pain in the butt to update things.
Yes, 100%. And that's actually one of the small areas that the digital board games, you know, the Tabletopia and the TTS, mm-hmm. those areas kind of help, is that it, those changes to games can be done a lot easier because you're just uploading a new design. You're not printing it, cutting it, sleeving it, stickering it, labeling it, writing on it, which I did way too much of.
100%. I will say that's like one of the only good things that came from more playtesting because of COVID. A lot quicker to update prototypes.
Yeah, and I'm not a big fan of digital board games, but they definitely have helped during this pandemic.
100% agree. And then as far as games that you might have coming in the future, do you have any projects that you want to talk about?
Yeah, my goodness. I have three that I'm very excited about. So these were pitched and developed during the pandemic. The first one will be hitting Kickstarter next month. It's called Earth. It is an engine builder, tableau builder, card drafting, resource management game built around Earth, being the planet and the natural synergies in the world. It's by Maxime Tardif, who's out of Quebec, out of Montreal. And he's done an amazing job designing this game and put a ton of time and work into the balancing of the cards. And it makes, the engine building and the excitement and enjoyment of that process, but also much faster than a lot of the engine builders that we're probably all thinking about right now. And then I just spent a lot of time making it as beautiful as I could. So because it is built around Earth, is I wanted to bring in as much beautiful artwork as I could to make the game look as good as I could. And for this time, for the first time of any of our games, actually, we're using all real world photography. So not photoshopped, not drawn, nothing. It's just all actual photos of these real life plants, the flora and fauna of our world. And it's just, it's beautiful. Beautiful to look at and great to play, really rewarding, fast, plays 1 to 5 players, really, really enjoyable. So that's going to be hitting Kickstarter in February. Then after that, I have a draft and write game from a Portuguese designer, Bruno Maciel, who pitched the game to us, and I absolutely loved it. It's probably the most played game, the fastest in our collection ever. Because it was during the pandemic, my regular testers couldn't get together and meet in person. So I printed off the prototypes and played it with my family, and my wife and kids and I absolutely loved it. And we probably played it 15 to 20 times in that first weekend alone. You're basically drafting cards to create your own, world touring band. So you have your star, your front singer, you have your musicians, you have your backstage crew, and you have your production crew. You need to travel the world, go to these different venues. You need to plan the different bookings you have, the assets you need to manage. And it's great because it's just so rewarding. It's as simple as, everyone has 5 cards, draft one, pass, draft one, pass, draft one, pass. And as you're doing it, you're unlocking these things. Oh, I got, a new thing here. I got a new thing here. So you're checking off this one thing, making this little small change here, creating these synergies. And as you're putting the band together, not only are you worried about the victory point value or the star power of these different people, but you're also worried about how they interact together and how, do their tempos, do their pitch, do the melodies, do they synchronize with the people playing beside them? And then those unlock more possibilities. So again, it's very simple, quick, but it's rewarding experience of like, oh, I did this. Oh. And it builds us to this, cascading effect of unlocking things and makes it a really enjoyable, fun experience as you create these sometimes cool, sometimes wacky musical bands that will then travel the world. That'll be probably be middle of this year on Kickstarter. And then after that is Terminus, and that's by Earl Esperus, I'm going to mess up both of their names, and Tom Philippe, who are both out of Toronto. And Terminus is a route building game, but based on kind of the planning and development more than the actual laying of the routes. So it's a rondel, and in the rondel, it's with your action selection. And it's definitely the crunchiest, heaviest, thinkiest game that Inside Up Games has ever published. And it's really, really enjoyable because it's all about that the planning and the development and the forethought that kind of goes into the building of these subway lines, and then the building of the lines, the intersection of the points, the sharing of the routes, the developments of the areas. It's been a lot of fun to develop the game with them to the point it is now. I think it's going to do really well as well.
I love how different all three of those games are. I'm excited to see them all on Kickstarter.
Yeah, thank you. Well, that's one of the things, because we're so small, one of my ideas for the company is basically that I want someone to be able to walk by our booth at a convention or in a store and see, you know, Inside Up Game titles, and maybe one of our titles, maybe Goris Maximus is, you know, too violent of a cover, or you don't like card games, or maybe Summit, you know, you're not into the survival aspect, whatever it is. But I want to make sure either our art style or our theme or mechanics, that something will appeal to you to kind of, like, as I say, get you to at least come over and check out our booth, check out our offerings. So we're trying to always, you know, find something different than what we've done before, as opposed to just, you know, doing the same thing again and again. And all three games definitely scratch itches we haven't done before.
That's so cool. Yeah, I know that when I walked by your guys' booth, it was pretty big at PAX Unplugged. And I was like, oh, I've seen this and this and this. Like, I've played, I think, three of your titles at this point, and I'm excited to play some more in the future.
Yeah, and it was good. It was hard because we had three titles release during the darn pandemic. So all of their, you know, planned convention releases never happened. So they just kind of released into the darkness. So PAX was busy because we were trying to show so many games.
Well, it seemed like you guys were always busy when I walked by. So that's hopefully what was the reality.
Yeah, it was. It was great. PAX was, yeah, very busy for us, which was wonderful.
Well, awesome. And then is there anything else you want to talk about your company? Or otherwise, we can wrap up this episode.
Yeah, no. Basically, if anyone is interested in any of the games we've talked about, you'll be able to, you know, learn about them through social media. We're everything at Inside Up Games. So that's Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I think we're going to create a TikTok account. Not sure we're going to actually be able to use it properly. But yeah, basically on all the social media, or you can follow us on our website, or if you follow or look for Connor McGoy on Kickstarter, you can follow us there and be notified of when these games launch.
Well, awesome. So then thank you for joining us for this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 30, Summit the Board Game. Thanks again, Connor. And as like a parting question, I want to know, if you could switch your name out, so like you changed history and now you designed a board game that wasn't necessarily your design, what one would you choose?
What game would I choose to design that wasn't mine? Oh, goodness. I'm going to put too much thought into this, and I should have just went with something quick. A game that I could have designed. How about Any game you want.
It could be chess. Any game you want.
Oh, yeah, that'd be a good one. Yeah, I'm going to take chess. I'm going to just steal that answer. Chess is such a great game.
That's fair. No, I mean, everyone knows it, so everyone would know you, and I'm not going to lie. I have no idea who created chess.
Although I'm too logical, the issue with that means that chess wouldn't have existed until either I existed or I would have existed when chess was first created. And both of those options sound pretty bad.
Oh my gosh. Well, I guess that's what past Connor's problem.
Exactly.
Oh man. Well, hey, thanks for coming on the show. I had a great time talking about Summit and all your other games.
Thanks, Daniel. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
This has been another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out NoDirectionPodcast.com. Join us next time.